Welcome to MGO Podcast 9. Now you know what I'm going to do. Captain's Log, Supplemental. This is an MGO Podcast where we interview Abdul El Sayed, who's running for governor of Michigan. You might be interested. You might not be interested. If you're not interested, please don't at me. Hi, you probably weren't expecting a podcast, but a guy who was running for governor was like, hey, do you want to do a podcast? And we were like, okay.
Yeah, it sounds good.
And also, Ace is less hirsute than usual, so we thought that would be worth celebrating.
Yeah, you dragged me out while I was mostly clean shaven.
So before we actually get started, we're going to talk to Abdul El Sayed. This is the third time we've had a political figure on the podcast. The previous two were candidates for regent. they've all been Democrats. If you are a Republican, we will talk to you.
Yes.
We will try to be as fair as possible to you, despite Ace's personal leanings and my personal leanings. But, I mean, if you want to talk to us, we think that we do a good job of laying things on the table and letting people decide for yourself as such a...
Yeah, but we welcome the discussion.
But, yeah, like, if you want to talk to us, we're listening. So reach out, and we'll talk to you. I want to talk to Abdul El Sayed right now. First of all, you have a very depressing Wikipedia page.
Oh, no.
not from your perspective, but I like, all right, let's get some background on Abdul El Sayed. And is that, am I pronouncing that correctly? Okay, good. And it's like, he's 33 and he's done all this stuff. And I'm like, I did one thing, but you've done a lot of stuff. Well, so congratulations on that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I've had a lot of great opportunities and a lot of great mentors. And I think one of the most incredible things about having been able to come to school at Michigan was that it was a great opportunity to explore a lot of interests and to meet a lot of great people. So I'm really just very privileged to have had some great people in my life. And a lot of that starts in Ann Arbor.
So you at 30 became the head of the Detroit Health
Department.
And there was a note in this Wikipedia page that they just kind of threw you into the back of an office with five employees.
Yeah. So I'll tell you about how I got there. So I became a doctor because I love people and I love science. And for me, the thing I wanted to do with my health degrees was to be able to tackle disparities in access to health. And so I did a PhD in public health. I also went to medical school. Came to appreciate that a lot of the things that make people sick have a lot more to do with if they have access to some very basic things. A good job that allows them a living wage, that puts a good roof over their head, allows them to drink clean water and breathe clean air. And realized that as a clinician, while I'd be dealing with the back end of those disparities, I wasn't going to be in a good place to be able to actually solve them. And so instead, I dedicated my career to public health and became a professor when I graduated college. I mean, when I graduated from my medical degree and realized that I really loved the work. I just was really far removed from actually doing the work that mattered. And I got a little bit frustrated in that academic role, writing paper after paper in my research to people who already kind of agreed with what I had to say. So was looking for an opportunity to get my hands dirty, actually solve the problems that I cared about. And that led me back home with the opportunity to rebuild the health department in Detroit. A friend of mine had just started working for the mayor. And I reached out to him to just learn about city opportunities and city work.
And he gave you a job. He was like, you do this.
So basically what happened is within 2 weeks, I had a lunch with the mayor and had sort of done all this reading on public health in Detroit and what we could do and put together this sort of slide set about what I thought we needed to do. And within 2 weeks, he's like, you got the job. And at that point, I was like, I think
that's a tough job to fill.
Yeah, what job? He's like, well, the directorship of the health department. I was like, okay, great. Didn't realize as much about where the health department was. Now, the health department, when the city was taken over by emergency managers, they made the decision to shut down their 185-year-old health department in a city with a higher infant mortality rate than my father's native Egypt. And I walked into a newly republicized, right, because they had privatized it, newly republicized health department that had 5 employees and 85 contractors in the back of the building where people pay parking tickets. No joke. First day of work. I'm walking in bright and early, and you know, I put on my big boy suit and my big boy tie, and I'm getting ready, talking myself up. You're the commissioner. You're going to commission. Actually, I have no idea what that means.
No, that's good though. Yeah.
This guy walks up to me. He's like, "Hey, you work here?" I looked at him. I was like, "You're the commissioner." Yes, yes, I do work here. He's like, "Great, can you take my parking ticket in for me?" And I was like, "No, I'm the health director." He's like, "Why are you walking into the parking building?" I was like, "You know, that's a damn good question." We took his parking ticket in, got it paid, felt really good about myself for about 5 minutes.
Probably gets a discount for paying early too.
Yeah. That's right. And then realized the enormity of what I walked into.
And that was 3 years ago.
That was 3 years ago. We were able to do some great work. We more than doubled the size of the staff, multiplied city funding for public health about 10 times, and most importantly, set our department on a pathway to breaking down the barriers that our kids had to being able to learn and earn in Detroit like we would want for any child anywhere by empowering moms and their kids. We're able to do things like make sure every child had a free pair of glasses if they needed a pair, 7,000 pairs of glasses for kids who wouldn't get them. And we did that because we found that 30% of our kids would come back testing positive after they'd already had a vision test. Literally a whole year sitting in the back of the class without the ability to even see the blackboard. And stood up to some of the biggest polluters in the state, had every school, daycare, and Head Start tested for lead in the water, built a mentorship program for young women who are newly pregnant and didn't necessarily have family supports that they could rely on, did work to try and get the lead out of homes and make sure that every kid had a wraparound if they were exposed to lead.
A wraparound is?
So access to the city nursing staff, being able to work with the family to make sure that we were providing those families with adequate testing for their homes, support if they owned a home to get the lead out of the walls.
So this is like a whole
system.
System,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of systems, Flint obviously has been in the news because their water was poisonous for a very long period of time. 7 people were arrested, 3 of them charged with involuntary manslaughter after an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. The state declared Flint's water clean in January of 2018. Mm-hmm. Could that have been faster? Is it sufficient what the state has done? And if you're governor, I mean, are you going to start giving Flint bottled water again? Or do you think the state of their water is currently acceptable?
So I'll tell you this. If you know that state government lied about poisoning your water for a really long time and withheld information that they know, and then all of a sudden they come up to you and be like, "No, trust us, the water's clean," what do you do?
Well,
and so
if they've, well, you know, so if they've fired everybody, if they've turned over a new leaf, and if they do know that they will go to jail if these tests aren't, mm-hmm. like, I feel like you have to have the ability to believe that the DEQ has reformed itself enough to be trusted. Otherwise, you can't have a DEQ, right? Like,
I think you know, for folks like you and I who didn't go through that traumatic experience,
sure, I understand.
I think it's easy to sort of look at that and say, well, there's got to be some objectivity here. To me, I don't believe that we have met our responsibility to the people of Flint until we've gotten all of the leaded pipes out of the ground. And the fact is, it's been 4 years and the people in Flint still don't have clean water that they can trust.
So the January report from the DEQ, I think it feels sufficient.
So the way that those measurements are made,
yeah.
is they tend to take water from a couple of particular points. And the fact is that it does not guarantee that water is safe and below a leaded standard at any particular point. Here's the other thing. The lead standards that we were using in the past still account for some amount of lead in the water.
They do.
And the only right number is 0. Lead is not a naturally occurring thing, right? We have to actually put it places. It's not like you can be walking around in a field and all of a sudden get exposed to lead. It's because it's in the piping. And so, you know, I believe that we have a responsibility to the people of Flint to get all of the lead out of the piping, because if I was a resident of Flint, I would not trust anything the DEQ told me, which means that at this point
I
right now...
I totally understand that.
at this point right now, we've got a responsibility to make sure that every kid and every family is made completely whole. And the money is there to do it. It just hasn't happened fast enough. And that's all entirely around bureaucratic coordination and the willingness to make this the most important issue. And you hear this word floating around in bureaucratic circles about Flint fatigue. And to me, it is a disgusting word, set of words to be using, because the only people who can have Flint fatigue are people who've had to deal with this crisis in Flint, right? Who've lived it every right. day. I spent a lot of time in Flint, and I was just there on Saturday for a forum that was hosted by the Michigan Legislative Black Caucus, and they invited all of the candidates for governor, and only the Democrats showed up, which includes Brian Kelly, who is the sitting lieutenant governor, and includes Bill Schuette, who is the sitting attorney general, who chose not to come to Flint despite the fact that they are sitting government employees who have some purchase over the circumstances in which we work. And I'll also say this. I sat on a childhood lead elimination board that was sponsored by the state, and I led a number of the efforts on that board to create a report. And the fact is that the report that was ultimately published looked a bit different than the one that we turned in. And for me, that was the moment, the wake-up call that I said, you know what? We need leadership that's going to stand up on this issue and put the people of this city first. Because at the end of the day, when you have lead poisoning rates like you do of 15%.
Can I stop you for a second? Sure. Kind of go back.
Yeah, absolutely.
You said that the money is there for this.
Yeah.
Do you have an approximate amount for how much this would cost?
So there's money set aside by the federal government to get this done, right. And then some set aside by the state government. And here's the thing. The state government keeps a rainy day fund of tens of billions of dollars.
Okay.
And they didn't touch a dime of the rainy day fund. And I don't know what a rainy day looks like if it's not poisoning 9,000 kids and 100,000 okay. people in a city like Flint. Do you see what I'm saying? The money is there.
I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, no. The frustration to me is that it has not been prioritized.
Okay.
Right? And I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what a priority looks like in my own, the way I put together in the world.
Yeah.
I don't know what a priority looks like if it's not making sure that you are getting lead out of the piping in the ground after you've poisoned 9,000 kids, you know?
I just getting some clarifications here. You said that you created a report from the state when you were sitting on this board for getting lead out of kids' homes, and the report that you, like the next level up, changed your report?
Yeah, so there were some edits put in the report and things taken out that at that point to me just said, you are too worried about the politics and you're not worried enough about the substance.
And who, what group of people was directly above you?
It's the Snyder administration.
It's the Snyder administration.
Yeah. And you know,
and this was after all the Flint stuff had started happening.
Yeah. And our charge was to advise about the set of best possible policies to eliminate lead poisoning okay. in Michigan. And here's the thing about lead poisoning that folks don't understand. In a community like Flint, it's because of the water. But most lead poisoning in Michigan is a result of housing.
Right.
So if a house is built before 1978, the high probability, unless it's been fully abated, is that there is some lead in it somewhere. And if the house is not in good repair, the lead is in the paint, in the walls,
right.
and it comes out. And,
right.
and here's the worst thing about it, is it often chip out, often sits in the windowsills. And so in summer months, when you're opening and closing the windows because it's hot, it comes out in a dust. And the thing about lead dust is that it's sweet. And so if you're a small child crawling around and you've got this dust and you get it in your mouth because kids put everything in their mouth.
I'm aware.
So we've got a responsibility to make sure that we're thinking big about how we eliminate lead poisoning in Michigan. That's one of several issues, right? But Flint, to me, canary in the coal mine around our failure to invest in our infrastructure and our failure to build government that is focused on solving a set of problems rather than delivering for the big corporations who've often bought and sold politicians because of their ability to both lobby and to donate into politicians' campaign coffers.
Okay, so how do you fix a problem like the DEQ then? So at the beginning of this crisis, they had a couple of high readings that would have maybe not prevented, but at least made this problem more obvious a lot more quickly. They dropped those readings so that mm-hmm. they get under the threshold that's
mm-hmm.
federal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a number of people who are kind of like time servers. This isn't the kind of administration that turns over every new governor, if I'm correct.
So you have a civil service, and then right. you have you have the leadership at the top.
And so the civil service level is making some of these decisions, mm-hmm. and it's very CYA. We've seen it in the athletic department and the previous regime.
I was wondering when that would come up.
I made it like 10 minutes.
Yeah, I was impressed.
How do you prevent this kind of careerist protection of your own well-being? I guess, I mean, there have been arrests here, but like...
Yeah. So a lot of the way a complex bureaucratic system operates is based on a culture that's set at the top. And the culture that was set at the top under the Snyder administration is one where it said, we don't value our civil servants. We want to do everything that we can to cut cost, right? And that is largely your labor. And we don't want to have to deal with complexity that arises in the world. So we'd rather you kind of make it go away. And the culture that we need to see across state government and frankly across government itself is our job is to serve people. Our job is to identify the challenges that they face, to be honest about what is causing those challenges, and then to do what we can to solve them. You will never get in trouble because of what happens in the world, but you will always get in trouble if you are not doing everything you can to support the people in the world, right? That pay us, right? Pay our salaries, who are, we are here literally as civil servants and public servants to serve. And that culture is set at the top. And you've seen this across the board in the Snyder administration. It's not just the DEQ. It's also the fact that you have this huge insurance, unemployment insurance fraud system that defrauded people who actually did need unemployment and still hasn't paid it back. And in the MDHHS around Flint as well. And so what we have to do is a couple of things. Number one, we have to value the work that those civil servants do and say, listen, what you do, the end outcome of what you do is protecting people's health and it matters and we value you. Second, we know that cutting your salaries and laying off people who are your compatriots in the work, that sends a message to you about how important you are. So we've got to stop doing that. And then third, we've got to recognize that in this administration, our job is to serve people and to protect the public's health and not necessarily simply to cut costs, to cut cost's sake. And if you look at what happened to the DEQ's budget under Rick Snyder, it went down tremendously to now $27 million bare bones budget. I stood up against the DEQ specifically around Marathon Petroleum back in early 2016 when they had wanted to raise their emissions of sulfur dioxide. And it was the awkward position of being the health director in the city testifying to DEQ representatives about why they should not allow Marathon Petroleum to raise its emissions. But we've limited their capacity to actually promulgate rules. We've limited their capacity to actually work as the inspectors and the regulators that they're supposed to be. And largely that's because the funders of people like Rick Snyder don't want to see that happen. And even now, the legislature's considering a set of legislation that would take away the DEQ's right to even regulate. And instead, regulation decisions would be made by a board of CEOs of these large companies that they're supposed to be regulating themselves.
Abdul, you have too much information on this topic. We have a lot of things to cover. I think we've done a good job.
I haven't even asked about single payer.
And let's move into that.
Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you plan? I mean, I know you support it, obviously. Yeah. You know, people hear single payer and they think enormous costs. So what's kind of your plan to implement that
if you
become governor?
So we've launched a plan called MichiCare. And what MichiCare would do would be implementing state-level single-payer healthcare. Here's the thing we all got to remember. We already pay the cost of healthcare. We pay more in healthcare costs than any other high-income country in the world, any other country in the world, both as a proportion and in absolute costs. 19 cents on the dollar for every dollar spent in our economy is spent on healthcare. That's crazy. You compare that to Canada, where they spend 11 cents on the dollar. So we already pay for it. It just comes out in different ways, right? If you're the average Michigander, it's coming out both because your employer is paying upwards of 25 cents on the dollar for your costs of labor, right? What they pay you in your salary for healthcare on top of it. And then you have to pay a monthly that usually comes out of your payroll, right? And then on top of that, if you actually want to use your healthcare, you got to call them up and be like, hey, here's why I actually warrant this was warranted, right? And you got to worry about your deductible, your premium, right? You got to worry about if your doctor's in network or out of network. So we already pay for it.
Yeah.
The question becomes, how do we deal with two things? Number one, the incentives in the system that basically allow providers to take advantage of people. It's like going to a mechanic. You never know if they actually just want to fleece you or they actually think something's wrong. And more importantly, get rid of the middleman, right? Which is the insurance industry, right? They make 15 cents on the dollar for every dollar spent in healthcare. And that's why Blue Cross's CEO made $13 million last year. So the question becomes, how do we bring that under one umbrella, reduce the middleman cost, and then change the incentives in the system? We believe we can provide healthcare 10 cents cheaper on the dollar immediately. And over time, that becomes even cheaper still because we're changing the incentives in the system. So we align it around health, not healthcare. People don't want to buy healthcare. Nobody walks around and be like, I can't wait to get an MRI. At best, you don't want an MRI. But if your knee hurts and you need an MRI, you might want to get one, right? Yeah. So we want to pay for health and not healthcare. And our plan would save the average Michigan family about $5,000 a year. Right? Michigan family making $48,000. So $5,000 is a big chunk of change. It's 10%. It would save businesses tremendous amount of money. So we would pay for it in two ways. One would be a payroll tax that would be graduated. And one would be a gross receipts tax on business. And here's the thing. It doesn't start over $2 million. So 75% of businesses don't pay a dime. And then those other those 25% of businesses that do pay something, they're paying upwards of what, 2% of gross receipts? You got to imagine what they're paying in healthcare right now. So we all save money, right? The system becomes less expensive, and then over time, it gives even less expensive over time because of the changing incentives. And here's two other things. Number one, we pay the highest rates in auto insurance in the country in Michigan, and that's because we ask auto insurance to be health insurance too. If you just give everybody health insurance, then auto insurance go back to being auto insurance. And then second, if you're a senior, high likelihood is you're taking at least one prescription drugs, and many of our seniors are on two or three. They're paying the highest rates in the world. And if we as a state were willing to stand up a single payer system, we then negotiate on behalf of all of our seniors, bringing down the cost for everybody. So this is the right thing to do now. Is the health insurance industry going to go nuts? Yes, they already are. They're sinking tons of money into one of my opponents because, you know, she's unwilling to say the word single payer. But my job is to say what's right and then fight to build that thing because, you know, who wants a sold out government? Because that's all we've gotten for a really long time. And I think it's time for us to actually be honest about why government makes the decisions it does and then ask ourselves what the best possible scenario is and work to that. Is it going to be a hard fight? Absolutely. But, you know, I went to the University of Michigan. We take on hard fights.
And are there transition costs with that you're worried about?
So early on, there will be some transition costs. But to be clear, those costs actually get paid for very, very quickly. And for most Michiganders, they won't see that at all, right? There's sort of an industry transition cost because we're changing the industry around a little bit. But for most Michiganders, all they're seeing is they're going from having to pay this monthly to all of a sudden it just comes out of payroll and they don't necessarily have to worry about in-network, out-of-network, having to pay a copay, a deductible, a premium. The experience should be pretty smooth. But, you know, we've heard those words before. And I'll tell you, as somebody who's both a doctor and a health administrator, we're not going to make the same mistake that healthcare.gov made.
Which is what, Drupal? Or is that too inside baseball?
It might be, but
we are not.
That was the most MGO blog possible thing you could have said. So,
did you have anything else on that?
Especially given recent developments in the Supreme Court, how do you plan to kind of protect women's health, protected classes of people?
It's kind of outside the scope of a governorhood, isn't it?
Well, I'd like to hear whether he thinks so.
Yeah, well,
listen, we've got a president right now who does not understand fundamentally what this country was built on.
Or math.
That too. We'll start with civics and then we'll go to math.
Sure, yeah.
I believe that all of us who either are in public service or aspire to public service, we hold the responsibility of not just the technical work of making sure that government works for people, but it's also the values work of demanding that we meet our ideals about who we are and who we want to be. I'm going to swear an oath to the Constitution of the United States of America and the Constitution of this state. And that Constitution is built on a set of ideals, and I do not believe it within my set of response. I don't believe that I have a right except for to hold our country accountable to that Constitution. Even as I see the President of the United States, who took the same oath, right, doing otherwise. And we've always been the kind of country that was the shining city on a hill, the place that people aspired to come. That's why my dad came here, right? His mom was a vegetable salesman. His mom was a an illiterate homemaker, wisest human being I've yet to meet. His father was a vegetable salesman, and he took a bet on this place being a place where it shouldn't matter the color of his skin, how he prayed, the fact that his name was Muhammad, that he could be just as American as anyone else. And that has always been our America. You look at what's happened with the family separation tragedy. And this is a president who does not understand that these people want to come here because they believe in the American dream. And for no other reason except for that they want a better life for themselves and their children, they're having their children ripped away from them to defend America. There is nothing less American than that.
You won't get any arguments from either of us on that. What does the governor of Michigan, what can he do?
Yeah.
In that situation.
So I'll tell you this. We as a state under my leadership will not participate with ICE in any way, shape, or form. We will not be using state funds to facilitate the deportation of Michiganders, documented or not. And that means that our state police, that means that our state penitentiaries will not be used to enforce an immigration policy that at best is incoherent and at worst is heartless. That also means that we will not differentiate around documentation status when making decisions about access to resources that the state provides. If you're a taxpaying Michigander, I don't care if you're documented or you're not, you're a Michigander. And that kind of responsibility is about trying to make up where the federal government is failing. And it's not just immigration policy. It's also protecting our Great Lakes, right? Under previous leaders who understood that, well, Michigan is home to 85% of the country's fresh water, the Great Lakes were a priority. And in budgets that we're seeing out of the Trump administration, they're trying to cut funding for both research and protection for the Great Lakes. And we've got a responsibility to protect that resource. Not only is it mission critical to the state of Michigan, it's also mission critical to the United States of America. And if the federal government is not going to act, we will. And that's a responsibility. And then lastly, the bully pulpit. Look, you know, fact is, I know most of the listeners probably don't see me. I'm a 215-pound man. A lot of people want to send a message to Donald Trump. And electing a, at that point, 34-year-old Muslim American, Egyptian American doctor governor is probably the best thing we can do to send a 215-pound middle finger to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I was about to say, you're positing yeah. yourself as a middle finger. All right, well, that is...
A chubby middle finger, but you know.
Well, you're stocky.
I like to think of muscular.
Is that better?
I think that works.
Okay. he could play fullback.
That's what I played. In high school, I played some fullback, played some guard, played some middle linebacker, played some nose guard. And
I played quiz bowl.
Got a Harbaugh guy and a quiz bowl
guy. All right, that's topic three. Topic four, guess what topic four is, Ace?
I assume you've got some thoughts on housing.
Yes. So I live in Ann Arbor, which has seen the average home price go up 50%
yeah.
over the past 6 years. Prop A limits the increase in property taxable property value to the rate of inflation. So if I were to sell my house and buy another house in Ann Arbor with the equity that I have earned by sitting on my butt as a homeowner, I would pay 50% more taxes. Mm-hmm. A natural result of this is nobody will sell a house in Ann Arbor no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't downsize, you can't upsize, because the withering tax increase just isn't worth it.
Yeah.
This is good news for contractors. If you're trying to get an addition to your home in Ann Arbor, good luck. I've been trying to do it. They're very busy. Moreover, kind of in a general sense, maybe not so much in Michigan, there is a housing crisis nationally.
Yeah.
And a large part of this housing crisis is because of exclusionary zoning that prevents multifamily housing across vast areas of residential housing in the United States. Ann Arbor, maybe Grand Rapids, and we're seeing parts of Detroit. I guess Ann Arbor is not really gentrifying, but they're experiencing this kind of job-related huge uptick in housing costs. How do you address that as the governor?
Yeah, I think it's a really good set of questions. I think I'll give you the biggest set of housing and property tax-related issues, and then how we're going to solve it. Number one, the gentrification issue is gigantic. And what you're seeing, particularly in communities like Detroit, is people being priced out of homes. And that is critical to folks because, you know, their livelihoods are there. And a lot of this
Can we stop there? Do you mean renters or do you mean homeowners?
I mean both. Okay. So when it comes
How does a homeowner get priced out of the home?
tax foreclosure.
Okay.
36% of Detroit homeowners are going to get foreclosed upon for taxes because they're being assessed at about 50% the value of their home. Right. So you can imagine you were to, in Ann Arbor, let's say you own a, you know, $300,000 home. Imagine having to pay $150,000 in taxes. And here's the worst thing
about
it.
How does that happen? That's a backlog?
Part of that is a backlog. Part of that is also because of the way tax parcels are zoned. And so what's happening, right, is you're seeing a boom in downtown, in midtown. And if you are assessing property taxes based on that boom, but you live just outside of downtown and midtown in a relatively less well-to-do part of the city, right, you can imagine that you're now being assessed at the value.
I don't understand how those properties are dodging Prop A, though.
So, the question is, how do you decide what a property tax value is?
Right.
And the question is, how do you then draw a line, right, about where what value should be assessed together, or what parcel should be assessed together?
Okay.
And if you are thinking about folks, for example, who own a condo in downtown versus a home, a bungalow, just a mile away, in theory, right, they live in the same kind of community. In practice, that's definitely not true, right? And so if you're raising property taxes in Detroit specifically, right, and in probably most urban communities, right?
But Detroit
in particular.
Exactly.
So what happens is you're seeing rising property taxes
assessments
on people because they are grouped together in with the folks who own really nice condos.
So you sell your house and it's comparables nearby, and then you get the comparables nearby. And I still don't understand how that's going up more than the rate of inflation.
So
possible that we're kind of talking at cross purposes.
I think we might be talking at cross purposes.
So let's just move on.
In the circumstance in Detroit, right, you do have people who are being assessed at over 50% the value of their home.
All right. So what do you want to do about
that? So, number one, I think when we talk about assessments, there is a constitutional and statutory responsibility, right, to reassess more often. And we have not met the responsibility to do that in communities like Detroit because of...
To reassess the value of an individual home.
The value of an individual parcel, yeah.
Parcel.
And that's what's leaving people, like you said, because of the backlogs, right? Sure. Leaving people with rates that are way, way too high relative to the value of their actual home in terms of the potential for sale. And so we need to...
What's preventing this from getting fixed at a state level?
Bureaucracy. And the state hasn't got involved. So... To step back for a second, one of the biggest challenges we have for cities, whether it be Ann Arbor or Detroit, is that our cities are put in a position where they're not allowed to promulgate their own taxes in any real way, right? They are stuck, like you said, with the way Proposal A limits the change in property tax.
Yes.
And the way that we make decisions about education funding, which is a huge thing if you're trying to start a family, which usually is the most mobile set of families who are buying and selling homes, limits the values that communities, new urban communities, will have. And then we're seeing a huge influx of upper income folks into communities that were traditionally lower income, which means that you're changing the value of a home quite faster than people can afford it. And then we have the rental eviction issue, right? Which there is no state law that allows any sort of rent control. And right now we are preempting cities from being able to pass any sort of real rent control. And so all of that has created a circumstance where the state is holding cities back and holding homeowners in cities back. And so what we want to do is be able to pass a renter's bill of rights, where we would guarantee renters a certain set of rights to the landlords to prevent the eviction epidemic that we've seen in places like Detroit, to change or allow local communities to be able to promulgate their own fundraising opportunities. Three, change the way that we do revenue sharing. So at the state level, we're not meeting statutory revenue sharing responsibilities. So we're making sure that we're passing on the revenues that cities and municipalities deserve. And then four, change the way we think about Proposal A entirely, because it's not meeting the responsibility to schools. And at the same time, it's hurting the ways that housing markets ought to operate.
So, I mean, what, like, the specifics of, I mean, how you kind of break away from this idea that a house has to be an investment,
Yeah.
Like, I mean, how do you go about kind of, I mean, that's a tough one, right? Because everybody who's 50 or older is sitting in this house they bought in 1960 and it's their whole net worth. And, you know, you look at generational wealth, and what that does is it's just a massive transfer from the younger generations to the older generations based on housing policy. But
I've never thought about it that way. I think it's a really, really good point.
You need to read City Observatory, my friend.
It's called City Observatory?
Yeah.
All right.
.org. What are you doing?
I'm trying to show you.
Oh, no! All right.
I'm sorry. I just slowed Brian's roll.
No, that's
housing.
Fine. That's fine. So you're out of time.
Oh, no. We didn't even talk about the fun stuff.
We want to get to education quickly. Okay, I can transition into that. one thing that you were mentioning before is the fact that, you know, a lot of property value is built into a school system. And yeah. In Ann Arbor particularly, you see the school of choice stuff where, you know, people come into adjacent school districts and they still go to Ann Arbor schools. And to me, that seems like it's robbing Ypsilanti school districts mm-hmm. of its most dedicated parents. Mm. The people who can and will drive their school, their kids to Ann Arbor. It gives Ann Arbor more funding to do what they want to do, but it also kind of creates this kind of land grab for people. Do you support school of choice? I just assume that you're opposed to all charter schools. And
I'm not opposed to all charter schools. I'm opposed to anybody making money off of charter
schools.
Okay,
yeah, that's a good distinction.
So for-profit charter schools, but that's about 80% of charter schools in Michigan. So I oppose for-profit charter schools. And I also think the way that we authorize charter schools has to change. But when it comes to school of choice, I don't believe in it.
Okay.
I think what has happened is that it has accelerated the death spiral for public schools in low-income communities.
Sure.
And, you know, for me, that became imminently clear when I inspected city schools in Detroit, when the Detroit Federation of Teachers had to conduct a mass sick out, finally allowed the city inspectors to come in, and we saw things like mice dead in the corner. And if you look at not only just the contraction of the city of Detroit in terms of just lost people, but also school of choice and the promulgation of charter schools, you basically have lost access to a number of young people who are needed to be able to keep the overhead going to be able to sustain the schools. Not only that, but those schools were under emergency management largely because of decreases in funding. So the entire system has to be rethought. And
all right. I got to stop you because you're out of time according to your various apparatchiks.
Yeah,
We're 15 minutes over. I need a lightning round.
All right, lightning round.
Lightning round. Regents for Michigan State, you will presumably be at the state convention. Can we get some people who didn't go to Michigan State on the Democratic ticket, please?
I haven't.
Musalem can stay, but everybody else got to go.
Well, I'll tell you, I've actually known Brian Musalem for some time, and I think he's been fighting a good fight. I'll be honest. Yes, that Board of Regents has just,
it's two
time
R's.
And again have failed the MSU community. And whether
lightning
was,
round, lightning round, Abdul, come on.
Yes,
it's two R's. So you got two opportunities to break some straight tickets if you actually get some people in there who will dunk on Michigan State for many reasons they should be dunked on. Ballot proposal to legalize marijuana, yes or no?
Legalize it.
Ballot proposal to make redistricting a nonpartisan process.
Absolutely. No more gerrymandering.
Anything that the state can do to reduce spiraling costs at universities?
Yes. So we've actually launched just today what we're calling a My Scholars Grant.
Okay.
And we want to provide every single young person in our state coming from a family earning less than $150,000 a year access to a debt-free 2 or 4 year college education. Those are things that we can do. It wouldn't even be that expensive if we were willing to have some honest conversations about bringing back money that the corporations have taken as subsidies for the past several years. I think we get it done.
Favorite Michigan athlete of the last 15 years?
Charles Woodson. Not 15.
Oh, 15. That's depressing.
Making us feel
We're
going to
make
again.
It 20.
No. Wait. Charles Woodson would have been 1998. So I've been 20 years right now.
97, sir.
97, you're right. Thank you. So Seawood would have been my favorite of the past 20.
Yeah.
I got to say, of the last 15, I really loved watching Mike Hart play.
Good answer.
He was just a great, gritty player.
So that was 20 seconds of softball. And 39 minutes of policy. Thank you.
Not bad. But no notes either.
Yeah, good God. That's almost as depressing as the Wikipedia.
I really appreciate it. I'll be honest, this was a lot more of a palsy grilling than I usually get, and I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Well,
I've got to read.
You must have been waiting for that. He was just like, yeah, let's do this.
What was the website that you recommended?
CityObservatory.org.
CityObservatory.org.
I also recommend Sightline. I am a vehement YIMBY.
So all right.
There we go.
Thank you for so much. I appreciate you guys. It was a great conversation, and yeah. Go Blue. And thank you for keeping us abreast. Hey, Shea Patterson. I'm just saying.
We'll end on that. I was just asked by an apparatchik to add this special addendum to the podcast. To the owner of Big Ten Burrito, I'm sorry, they got sued. BTB, you promised Abdul El Sayed that you would name a burrito after him if he mentioned your store when he gave a commencement speech to the University of Michigan. He did that, and you have not held up your end of the bargain. So he wanted to call you out. Consider the gauntlet thrown down, sir.
Politics are just way too uncivil these days.
Ace! Cut it out!
Thanks for listening to the MGO podcast. I am Ace Amender along with Brian Cook. And we'd just like to thank Abdul El Sayed once again for not only sitting down and spending time with us, but giving us 40 solid minutes of policy talk without any notes, which makes me feel deeply inadequate.
Just like the Wikipedia page!